innkeeper even for a moment. Then he saw Quoth's eyes. They had deepened to a green so dark they were nearly black. "This is who I came to see," Chronicler thought to himself. "This is the man who counseled kings and walked old roads with nothing but his wit to guide him. This is the man whose name has become both praise and curse at the university." Quoth stared at Chronicler and Bast in turn. Neither could meet his eye for very long. After an awkward pause, Bast extended his hand. Chronicler hesitated for a bare moment before reaching out quickly, as if he were sticking his hand into a fire. Nothing happened. Both of them seemed moderately surprised.
"Amazing, isn't it?" Quoth addressed them bitingly. "Five fingers and flesh with blood beneath. One could almost believe that on the other end of that hand lay a person of some sort."
Guilt crept into the expressions of the two men. They let go of each other's hands. Quoth poured something from the green bottle into the glasses. This simple gesture changed him. He seemed to fade back into himself until there was little left of the dark-eyed man who'd stood behind the bar a moment ago. Chronicler felt a pang of loss as he stared at the innkeeper with one hand hidden in a linen rag.
"Now," Quoth pushed the glasses toward them, "take these drinks, sit at that table, and talk. When I come back, I don't want to find either one of you dead or the building on fire. Fair?"
Bast gave an embarrassed smile as Chronicler picked up the glasses and moved back to the table. Bast followed him and almost sat down before returning to grab the bottle too.
"Not too much of that," Quoth cautioned as he stepped into the back room. "I don't want you giggling through my story."
The two at the table began a tense, halting conversation as Quoth moved into the kitchen. Several minutes later he emerged, bringing out cheese and a loaf of dark bread, cold chicken and sausage, butter and honey. They moved to a larger table as Quoth brought the platters out, bustling about and looking every bit the innkeeper. Chronicler watched him covertly, finding it hard to believe that this man, humming to himself and cutting sausage, could be the same person who had stood behind the bar just minutes ago, dark-eyed and terrible. As Chronicler gathered his paper and quills, Quoth studied the angle of the sun through the window, a pensive look on his face. Eventually he turned to Bast.
"How much did you manage to overhear?"
"Most of it, Reshi," Bast smiled. "I have good ears."
"That's good. We don't have time to backtrack."
He drew a deep breath.
"Let's get back to it then. Brace yourselves. The story takes a turn now. Downward. Darker. Clouds on the horizon."
Chapter 14. The Name of the Wind. Winter is a slow time of year for a travelling troop, but Abenthi put it to good use and finally got around to teaching me sympathy in earnest. However, as is often the case, especially for children, the anticipation proved much more exciting than the reality. It would be wrong to say that I was disappointed with sympathy, but honestly, I was disappointed. It was not what I expected magic to be. It was useful. There was no denying that. Ben used sympathy to make light for our shows. Sympathy could start a fire without flint or lift a heavy weight without cumbersome ropes and pulleys. But the first time I'd seen him, Ben had somehow called the wind. That was no mere sympathy. That was storybook magic. That was the secret I wanted more than anything. Spring thaw was well behind us, and the troop was riding through the forests and fields of the Western Commonwealth. I was riding along as normal in the front of Ben's wagon. Summer was just deciding to make itself known again, and everything was green and growing. Things had been quiet for about an hour.
Ben was drowsing with the reins held loosely in one hand when the wagon hit a stone and jarred us both out of our respective reveries. Ben pulled himself more upright in his seat and addressed me in a tone I had grown to think of as, "Have I got a puzzle for you?"
"How would you bring a kettle of water to a boil?"
Looking around, I saw a large boulder by the side of the road. I pointed.
"That stone should be warm from sitting in the sun. I'd bind it to the water in the kettle and use the heat in the stone to bring the water to boil."
"Stone to water isn't very efficient," Ben chided me. "Only about 1 part in 15 would end up warming the water."
"It would work."
"I'll grant you that, but it's sloppy. You can do better, Elia."
He then proceeded to shout at Alpha and Beta, a sign that he was in a genuine good mood. They took it as calmly as ever, in spite of the fact that he accused them of things I'm sure no donkey has ever willingly done, especially not Beta, who possessed impeccable moral character. Stopping mid-tirade, he asked,
"How would you bring down that bird?"
He gestured to a hawk riding the air above a wheat field to the side of the road.
"I probably wouldn't. It's done nothing to me."
"Hypothetically."
"I'm saying that, hypothetically, I wouldn't do it."
Ben chuckled.
"Point made, Elia. Precisely how wouldn't you do it? Details, please."
"I'd get Terran to shoot it down."
He nodded thoughtfully.
"Good, good. However, it is a matter between you and the birds. That hawk," he gestured indignantly, "has said something uncouth about your mother."
"Ah, then my honour demands I defend her good name myself."
"Indeed it does."
"Do I have a feather?"
"No."
"Tailu hold and—"
I bit off the rest of what I was going to say at his disapproving look.
"You never make it easy, do you?"
"It's an annoying habit I picked up from a student who was too clever for his own good."
He smiled.
"What could you do even if you had a feather?"
"I'd bind it to the bird and lather it with lye soap."
Ben furrowed his brow, such as it was.
"What kind of binding?"
"Chemical, probably second catalytic."
A thoughtful pause.
"Second catalytic?"
He scratched at his chin.
"To dissolve the oil that makes the feather smooth?"
I nodded. He looked up at the bird.
"I've never thought of that,"
he said with a kind of quiet admiration. I took it as a compliment.
"Nevertheless," he looked back to me, "you have no feather. How do you bring it down?"
I thought for several minutes, but couldn't think of anything. I decided to try and turn this into a different sort of lesson.
"I would," I said casually, "simply call the wind and make it strike the bird from the sky."
Ben gave me a calculating look that told me he knew exactly what I was up to.
"And how would you do that, Elia?"
I sensed he might be ready to finally tell me the secret he had been keeping all through the winter months. At the same time, I was struck with an idea. I drew in a deep breath and spoke the words to bind the air in my lungs to the air outside. I fixed the ala firmly in my mind, put my thumb and forefinger in front of my pursed lips, and blew between them. There was a light puff of wind at my back that tousled my hair and caused the tarpaulin covering the wagon to pull taut for a moment. It might have been nothing more than a coincidence, but nevertheless, I felt an exultant smile overflow my face. For a second, I did nothing but grin like a maniac at Ben, his face dull with disbelief. Then I felt something squeeze my chest as if I was deep underwater. I tried to draw a breath but couldn't. Mildly confused, I kept trying. It felt as if I'd just fallen flat on my back and had the air driven from me. All in a rush, I realized what I had done. My body exploded into a cold sweat and I grabbed frantically at Ben's shirt, pointing at my chest, my neck, my open mouth. Ben's face turned from shocked to ashen as he looked at me. I realized how still everything was. Not a blade of grass was stirring. Even the sound of the wagon seemed muted, as if far off in the distance. Terror screamed through my mind, drowning out any thought. I began to claw at my throat, ripping my shirt open. My heart thundered through the ringing in my ears. Pain stabbed through my straining chest as I gasped for air. Moving more quickly than I had ever seen before, Ben grabbed me by the tatters of my shirt and sprang from the seat of the wagon. Landing in the grass by the side of the road, he dashed me to the ground with such a force that, if I'd had any air in my lungs, it would have been driven out of me. Tears streaked my face as I thrashed blindly. I knew that I was going to die. My eyes felt hot and red. I raked madly at the earth with hands that were numb and cold as ice. I was aware of someone shouting, but it seemed very far away. Ben kneeled above me, but the sky was getting dim behind him. He seemed almost distracted, as if he were listening to something I couldn't hear. Then he looked at me. All I remember were his eyes. They seemed far away and filled with a terrible power, dispassionate and cold. He looked at me. His mouth moved. He called the wind. A leaf in lightning, I shook, and the thunderclap was black. The next thing I remember was Ben helping me to my feet. I was dimly aware of the other wagons stopping and curious faces peering at us. My mother came away from our wagon, and Ben met her halfway, chuckling and saying something reassuring. I couldn't make out the words as I was focused on breathing deep in and out. The other wagons trundled on, and I followed Ben mutely back to his wagon. He made a show of puttering around, checking the cords that held the tarpaulin tight. I collected my wits and was helping as best I could when the final wagon in the troop passed us. When I looked up, Ben's eyes were furious.
"What were you thinking?" he hissed. "Well, what were you thinking?"
I'd never seen him like this before, his whole body drawn up into a tight knot of anger. He was shaking with it. He drew back his arm to strike me, then stopped. After a moment, his hand fell to his side. Moving methodically, he checked the last couple of ropes and climbed back onto the wagon. Not knowing what else to do, I followed him. Ben twitched the reins, and Alpha and Beta tugged the wagon into motion. We were last in line now. Ben stared straight ahead. I fingered the torn front of my shirt. It was tensely silent. In hindsight, what I had done was glaringly stupid. When I bound my breath to the air outside, it made it impossible for me to breathe. My lungs weren't strong enough to move that much air. I would have needed a chest like an iron bellows. I would have had as much luck trying to drink a river or lift a mountain. We rode for about 2 hours in an uncomfortable silence. The sun was brushing the tops of the trees when Ben finally drew in a deep breath and let it out in an explosive sigh. He handed me the reins. When I looked back at him, I realized for the first time how old he was. I had always known he was nearing his third score of years, but I'd never seen him look it before.
"I lied to your mother back there, Quoth. She saw the end of what happened and was worried about you."
His eyes didn't move from the wagon ahead of ours as he spoke.
"I told her we were working on something for a performance. She's a good woman. She deserves better than lies."
We rode on in an endless agony of silence, but it was still a few hours before sunset when I heard voices calling,
"Greystone!"
down the line. The bump of our wagon turning onto the grass jostled Ben from his brooding. He looked around and saw the sun was still in the sky.
"Why are we stopping so early? Tree across the road?"
"Greystone."
I gestured up ahead to the slab of stone that loomed over the tops of the wagons ahead of us.
"What?"
"Every once in a while we run across one by the road."
I gestured again to the greystone, peering over the tops of smaller trees by the roadside. Like most greystones, it was a crudely hewn rectangle about a dozen feet tall. The wagons gathering around it seemed rather insubstantial compared to the stone's solid presence.
I've heard them called standing stones, but I've seen a lot of them that weren't standing, just lying on their sides. We always stop for the day when we find one, unless we're in a terrible hurry.
I stopped, realizing I was babbling.
I've known them by a different name. Waystones,
Ben said quietly. He looked old and tired. After a moment he asked,
Why do you stop when you find one?
We just always do. It's a break from the road,
I thought for a moment.
I think they're supposed to be good luck.
I wished I had more to say to keep the conversation going. His interest piqued. But I couldn't think of anything else.
I suppose they could be at that.
Ben guided Alpha and Beta into a spot on the far side of the stone, away from most of the other wagons.
Come back for dinner or soon afterwards. We need to talk.
He turned without looking at me, and began to unhitch Alpha from the wagon. I'd never seen Ben in a mood like this before. Worried that I'd ruined things between us, I turned and ran to my parents' wagon. I found my mother sitting in front of a fresh fire, slowly adding twigs to build it up. My father sat behind her, rubbing her neck and shoulders. They both looked up at the sound of my feet running towards them.
Can I eat with Ben tonight?
My mother looked up at my father, then back to me.
You shouldn't make yourself a nuisance, dear. He invited. If I go now, I can help him set up for the night.
She wiggled her shoulders, and my father started rubbing them again. She smiled at me.
Fair enough, but don't keep him up until the wee hours.
She smiled at me.
Give me a kiss.
She held out her arms, and I gave her a hug and a kiss. My father gave me a kiss, too.
Let me have your shirt. It'll give me something to do while your mother fixes dinner.
He skinned me out of it and fingered the torn edges.
This shirt is holy, holy, more than it has any right to be.
I started to stammer out an explanation, but he waved it aside.
I know, it was all for the greater good. Try to be more careful, or I'll make you sew it yourself.
There's a fresh one in your trunk. Bring me needle and thread while you're in there, if you'd be so kind. I made a dash into the back of the wagon and drew on a fresh shirt. While I rummaged around for needle and thread, I heard my mother singing.
In evening, when the sun is setting fast, I'll watch for you from high above. The time for your return is long since past, but mine is ever faithful love.
My father answered,
In evening when the light is dying, my feet at last are homeward turning. The wind is through the willows sighing, please keep the hearth fire burning.
When I came out of the wagon, he had her in a dramatic dip and was giving her a kiss. I set the needle and thread next to my shirt and waited. It seemed like a good kiss. I watched with a calculating eye, dimly aware that at some point in the future, I might want to kiss a lady. If I did, I wanted to do a decent job of it. After a moment, my father noticed me and stood my mother back on her feet.
That will be a halfpenny for the show, Master Voyeur, he laughed. What are you still here for, boy? I'll bet you the same halfpenny that a question slowed you down.
Why do we stop for greystones?
Tradition, my boy, he said grandly, throwing his arms wide. And superstition. They are one and the same. Anyway, we stop for good luck and because everyone enjoys an unexpected holiday.
He paused.
I used to know a bit of a poem about them. How did it go? Like a drawstone, even in our sleep. Standing stone by old road is the way to lead you ever deeper into fay. Lay stone as you lay in hill or dell, graystone leads to something-something-L.
My father stood for a second or two looking off into space and tugging at his lower lip. Finally, he shook his head.
Can't remember the end of that last line. Lord, but I dislike poetry. How can anyone remember words that aren't put to music?
His forehead creased with concentration as he mouthed the words silently to himself.
What's a drawstone?
I asked.
It's an old name for lodestones, my mother explained. They're pieces of star iron that draw all other iron towards themselves. I saw one years ago in a curiosity cabinet.
She looked up at my father, who was still muttering to himself.
We saw the lodestone in Pelleresin, didn't we?
Hmm? What?
The question jogged him out of his reverie.
Yes, Pelleresin.
He tugged at his lip again and frowned.
Remember this, son. If you forget everything else, a poet is a musician who can't sing. Words have to find a man's mind before they can touch his heart, and some men's minds are woeful small targets. Music touches their hearts directly, no matter how small or stubborn the mind of the man who listens.
My mother made a slightly unladylike snort.
Elitist? You're just getting old.
She gave a dramatic sigh.
Oh, truly all the more's the tragedy. The second thing to go is a man's memory.
My father puffed up into an indignant pose, but my mother ignored him and said to me,
Besides, the only tradition that keeps troops by the greystone is laziness. The poem should run like this. Whatever the season, that I'm on the road, I look for a reason, loden or laystone, to lay down my load.
My father had a dark glimmer in his eye as he moved behind her.
Old?
He spoke in a low voice as he began to rub her shoulders again.
Woman, I have a mind to prove you wrong.
She smiled a wry smile.
Sir, I have a mind to let you.
I decided to leave them to their discussion and started to scamper back to Ben's wagon when I heard my father call out behind me,
Scales after lunch tomorrow? And the second act of Tinbertin?
Okay.
I burst into a jog. When I got back to Ben's wagon, he had already unhitched Alpha and Beta and was rubbing them down. I started to set up the fire, surrounding dry leaves with a pyramid of progressively larger twigs and branches. When I was finished, I turned to where Ben sat. More silence. I could almost see him picking out his words as he spoke.
How much do you know about your father's new song?
The one about Lanray? I asked.
Not much. You know what he's like. No one hears it until it's finished, not even me.
I'm not talking about the song itself, Ben said. The story behind it. Lanre's story.
I thought about the dozens of stories I'd heard my father collect over the last year, trying to pick out the common threads.
Lanre was a prince, I said. Or a king, someone important. He wanted to be more powerful than anyone else in the world. He sold his soul for power, but then something went wrong, and afterwards I think he went crazy, or he couldn't ever sleep again, or...
I stopped when I saw Ben shaking his head.
He didn't sell his soul, Ben said. That's just nonsense.
He gave a great sigh that seemed to leave him deflated.
Ugh, I'm doing this all wrong. Never mind your father's song, we'll talk about it after he finishes it. Knowing Lanry's story might give you some perspective.
Ben took a deep breath and tried again.
Suppose you have a thoughtless six-year-old. What harm can he do?
I paused, unsure what sort of answer he wanted. Straightforward would probably be best.
Not much.
Suppose he's 20, and still thoughtless. How dangerous is he?
I decided to stick with the obvious answer.
Still not much, but more than before.
What if you give him a sword?
Realization started to dawn on me, and I closed my eyes.
More. Much more. I understand, Ben, really, I do. Power is okay, and stupidity is usually harmless. Power and stupidity together are dangerous.
I never said stupid, Ben corrected me. You're clever. We both know that. But you can be thoughtless. A clever, thoughtless person is one of the most terrifying things there is. Worse, I've been teaching you some dangerous things.
Ben looked at the fire I'd laid out, then picked up a leaf, mumbled a few words, and watched a small flame flicker into life in the center of the twigs and tinder. He turned to look at me.
You could kill yourself doing something as simple as that, he gave a sickly grin. Or looking for the name of the wind.
He started to say something else, then stopped and rubbed his face with his hands. He gave a great sigh that seemed to deflate him. When he took his hands away, his face was tired.
How old are you again?
12 next month.
He shook his head.
It's so easy to forget that. You don't act your age.
He poked at the fire with a stick.
I was 18 when I began at the university, he said. I was 20 before I knew as much as you do now.
He stared into the fire.
I'm sorry, Quoth. I need to be alone tonight. I need to do some thinking.
I nodded silently. I went to his wagon, gathered tripod and kettle, water and tea. I brought them back and quietly laid them beside Ben. He was still staring into the fire when I turned away. Knowing my parents wouldn't expect me back for a while, I headed into the forest. I had some thinking of my own to do. I owed Ben that much. I wished I could do more. It took a full span of days before Ben was his normal, jovial self again. But even then, things weren't the same between us. We were still fast friends, but there was something between us, and I could tell he was consciously holding himself apart. Lessons ground to a near standstill. He halted my fledgling study of alchemy, limiting me to chemistry instead. He refused to teach me any sigildry at all, and on top of everything else, he began to ration what little sympathy he thought safe for me. I chafed at the delays, but held my peace, trusting that if I showed myself to be responsible and meticulously careful, he would eventually relax, and things would return to normal. We were family, and I knew that any trouble between us would eventually be smoothed over. All I needed was time. Little did I know, our time was quickly drawing to an end. Chapter 15. Distractions and Farewells. The town was called Hallowfell. We stopped for a handful of days because there was a good wainwright there, and nearly all our wagons needed tending or mending of some sort. While we were waiting, Ben got the offer he couldn't refuse. She was a widow, fairly wealthy, fairly young, and to my inexperienced eyes, fairly attractive. The official story was that she needed someone to tutor her young son. However, anyone who saw the two of them walking together knew the truth behind that story. She had been the brewer's wife, but he had drowned 2 years ago. She was trying to run the brewery as best she could, but she didn't really have the know-how to do a good job of it. As you can see, I don't think anyone could have built a better snare for Ben if they had tried. Plans were changed, and the troop stayed on at Hallowfell for a few extra days. My 12th birthday was moved up and combined with Ben's going away party. To truly understand what it was like, you must realize that nothing is so grand as a troop showing off for one another. Good entertainers try to make each performance seem special, but you need to remember that the show they're putting on for you is the same one they've put on for hundreds of other audiences. Even the most dedicated troops have an occasional lackluster performance, especially when they know they can get away with it. Small towns, rural inns, those places didn't know good entertainment from bad. Your fellow performers did.
Think, then, how do you entertain the people who have seen your act 1,000 times? You dust off the old tricks, you try out some new ones, you hope for the best, and, of course, the grand failures are as entertaining as the great successes. I remember the evening as a wonderful blur of warm emotion, tinged in bitter. Fiddles, lutes, and drums, everyone played and danced and sang as they wished. I dare say we rivaled any fairy revel you can bring to mind. I got presents. Trip gave me a belt knife with a leather grip, claiming that all boys should have something they can hurt themselves with. Shandy gave me a lovely cloak she had made, scattered with little pockets for a boy's treasures. My parents gave me a lute, a beautiful thing of smooth, dark wood. I had to play a song, of course, and Ben sang with me. I slipped a little on the strings of the unfamiliar instrument, and Ben wandered off looking for notes once or twice, but it was nice. Ben opened up a small keg of mead he had been saving for just such an occasion. I remember it tasting the way I felt, sweet and bitter and sullen. Several people had collaborated to write the Ballad of Ben, Brewer Supreme. My father recited it as gravely as if it were the Mordegan royal lineage while accompanying himself on a half-harp. Everyone laughed until they hurt, and Ben twice as much as everyone else. At some point in the night, my mother swept me up and danced around in a great spinning circle. Her laughter sang out like music trailing in the wind. Her hair and skirt spun around me as she twirled. She smelled comforting, the way only mothers do. That smell and the quick laughing kiss she gave me did more to ease the dull ache of Ben's leaving than all the entertainments combined. Shandy offered to do a special dance for Ben, but only if he came into her tent to see it. I'd never seen Ben blush before, but he did it well. He hesitated. And when he refused, it was obviously about as easy for him as tearing out his own soul. Shandy protested and pouted prettily, saying she'd been practicing it for a long time. Finally, she dragged him into the tent, their disappearance encouraged by a cheer from the entire troupe. Trip and Terran staged a mock sword fight that was one part breathtaking swordplay, one part dramatic soliloquy provided by Terran, and one part buffoonery that I'm sure Trip must have invented on the spot. It ranged all over the camp. In the course of the fight, Trip managed to break his sword, hide under a lady's dress, fence with a sausage, and perform such fantastical acrobatics that it's a miracle he didn't seriously injure himself. Although he did split his trousers up the back. Dax set himself alight while attempting a spectacular bit of fire breathing and had to be doused. All he suffered was a bit of singed beard and a slightly bruised pride. He recovered quickly under Ben's tender ministrations, a mug of mead, and a reminder that not everyone was cut out to have eyebrows. My parents sang The Lay of Sir Savian Trailliard. Like most of the great songs, Sir Savian was written by Ilion and generally considered to be his crowning work. It's a beautiful song, made more so by the fact that I'd only heard my father perform the whole thing a handful of times before. It's hellishly complex, and my father was probably the only one in the troupe who could do it justice. Though he didn't particularly show it, I knew it was taxing even for him. My mother sang the counter-harmony, her voice soft and lilting. Even the fire seemed subdued when they took a breath. I felt my heart lift and dive. I wept as much for the glory of two voices so perfectly enmeshed as for the tragedy of the song. Yes, I cried at the end of it. I did then, and I have every time since. Even a reading of the story aloud will bring tears to my eyes. In my opinion, anyone who isn't moved by it is less than human inside. There was a momentary quiet after they finished, wherein everyone wiped their eyes and blew their noses. Then, after a suitable period of recovery had elapsed, someone called out, "Lanray! Lanray!" The shout was taken up by several other people. "Yes, Lanray!" My father gave a wry smile and shook his head. He never performed any part of a song until it was finished.
"Come on, Al," Shandy called out. "You've been stewing it long enough. Let some out of the pot."
He shook his head again, still smiling.
"It's not ready yet."
He bent down and carefully set his lute into its case.
"Let's have a taste, Al Eden."
It was Terran this time.
"Yeah, for Ben's sake. It's not fair that he should have to hear you mumble over it for all this while and not get..."
"I'm wondering what you're doing in that wagon with your wife if it's not..." "Sing it, Lanray!"
Trip quickly organized the whole troop into a great chanting, howling mass that my father managed to withstand for almost a minute before he stooped and lifted his lute back out of the case. Everyone cheered. The crowd hushed as soon as he sat back down. He tuned a string or two, even though he'd only just set it down. He flexed his fingers and struck a few soft experimental notes, then swept into the song so gently that I caught myself listening to it before I knew it had begun. Then my father's voice spoke over the rise and fall of the music.
"Sit and listen all, for I will sing a story wrought and forgotten in a time old and gone, a story of a man, proud Lanray, strong as the spring, steel of the sword he had at ready hand. Hear how he fought, fell and rose again, to fall again, under shadow falling then. Love filled him, love for native land, and love of his wife Lyra, at whose calling some say he rose through doors of death to speak her name as his first reborn breath."
My father drew a breath and paused, his mouth open as if he would continue. Then a wide, wicked grin spread across his face, and he bent to tuck his lute safely away. There was an outcry and a great deal of complaining, but everyone knew they had been lucky to hear as much as they had. Someone else struck up a song for dancing, and the protests faded away. My parents danced together, her head on his chest. Both had their eyes closed. They seemed so perfectly content. If you can find someone like that, someone who you can hold and close your eyes to the world with, then you're lucky, even if it only lasts for a minute or a day. The image of them gently swaying to the music is how I picture love in my mind, even after all these years. Afterwards, Ben danced with my mother, his steps sure and stately. I was struck by how beautiful they looked together. Ben, old, grey and portly, with his lined face and half-burned eyebrows. My mother, slender, fresh and bright, pale and smooth-skinned in the firelight. They complemented each other by contrast. I ached knowing I might never see them together again. By this time, the sky was beginning to brighten in the east. Everyone gathered to say their final goodbyes. I can't remember what I said to him before we left. I know it felt woefully inadequate, but I knew he understood. He made me promise not to get myself into any trouble, tinkering with the things he had taught me. He stooped a bit and gave me a hug, then tousled my hair. I didn't even mind. In semi-retaliation, I tried to smooth out his eyebrows, something I'd always wanted to try. His expression was marvelous in its surprise. He gathered me into another hug. Then he stepped away. My parents promised to steer the troop back towards the town when we were in the area. All the troopers said they wouldn't need much steering. But even as young as I was, I knew the truth. It would be a great long time before I saw him again. Years. I don't remember starting out that morning, but I do remember trying to sleep and feeling quite alone, except for a dull, bittersweet ache. When I awoke later in the afternoon, I found a package resting next to me. Wrapped in sackcloth and tied with twine, there was a bright piece of paper with my name fixed to the top, waving in the wind like a little flag. Unwrapping it, I recognized the book's binding. It was Rhetoric and Logic, the book Ben had used to teach me argument. Out of his small library of a dozen books, it was the only one I hadn't read from cover to cover. I hated it. I cracked it open and saw writing on the inside cover. It said, Quoth, defend yourself well at the university. Make me proud. Remember your father's song. Be wary of folly. Your friend, Abenthy. Ben and I had never discussed my attending the university. Of course, I had dreams of going there someday, but they were dreams I hesitated to share with my parents. Attending the university would mean leaving my parents, my troop, everyone and everything I had ever known. Quite frankly, the thought was terrifying. What would it be like to settle in one place, not just for an evening or a span of days, but for months? Years. No more performing? No tumbling with Trip or playing the bratty young noble's son in Three Pennies for Wishing? No more wagons? No one to sing with? I'd never said anything aloud, but Ben would have guessed. I read his inscription again, cried a bit, and promised him that I would do my best. Chapter 16. Hope. Over the next months, my parents did their best to patch the hole left by Ben's absence, bringing in the other troopers to fill my time productively and keep me from moping. You see, in the troop, age had little to do with anything. If you were strong enough to saddle the horses, you saddled the horses. If your hands were quick enough, you juggled. If you were clean-shaven and fit the dress, you played Lady Raithiel in The Swineherd and the Nightingale. Things were generally as simple as that. So Trip taught me how to jape and tumble. Shandy walked me through the courtly dances of a half-dozen countries. Terran measured me against the hilt of his sword and judged that I had grown tall enough to begin the basics of swordplay. Not enough to actually fight, he stressed, but enough so I could make a good show of it on stage. The roads were good this time of year, so we made excellent time traveling north through the Commonwealth, 15-20 miles a day as we searched out new towns to play. With Ben gone, I rode with my father more often, and he began my formal training for the stage. I already knew a great deal, of course, but what I had picked up was an undisciplined hodgepodge. My father systematically went about showing me the true mechanics of the actor's trade, how slight changes in accent or posture make a man seem oafish or sly or silly. Lastly, my mother began teaching me how to comport myself in polite society. I knew a little from our infrequent stays with Baron Greyfallow, and thought I was quite genteel enough without having to memorize forms of address, table manners, and the elaborate snarled rankings of the peerage. Eventually, I told my mother exactly that. Who cares if a Medigan Viscount outranks a vintage Sparathane? I protested. And who cares if one is Your Grace and the other is My Lord? They care, my mother said firmly. If you perform for them, you need to conduct yourself with dignity and learn to keep your elbow out of the soup. Father doesn't worry about which fork to use and who outranks who. I groused. My mother frowned, her eyes narrowing. Who outranks whom? I said grudgingly. Your father knows more than he lets on, my mother said, and what he doesn't know he breezes past due to his considerable charm. That's how he gets by. She took my chin and turned my face toward her. Her eyes were green with a ring of gold around the pupil. Do you just want to get by, or do you want to make me proud? There was only one answer to that. Once I knuckled down to learn it, it was just another type of acting, another script. My mother made rhymes to help me remember the more nonsensical elements of etiquette, and together we wrote a dirty little song called "The Pontifex Always Ranks Under a Queen." We laughed over it for a solid month, and she strictly forbade me to sing it to my father, lest he play it in front of the wrong people some day and get us all into serious trouble.
"Tray!"
The shout came faintly down the line.
"Three-way talk!"
My father stopped in the middle of the monologue he had been reciting for me and gave an irritated sigh.
"Oh, that'll be as far as we get today, then,"
he grumbled, looking up at the sky.
"Are we stopping?"
my mother called from inside the wagon.
"Another tree across the road,"
I explained.
"I swear,"
my father said, steering the wagon to a clear space at the side of the road.
"Is this the King's Road, or isn't it? You think we were the only people on it. How long ago was that storm? 2 span?
"Not quite," I said. 16 days.
"And trees still blocking the road? I have a mind to send the consulate a bill for every tree we've had to cut and drag out of the way. This will put us another 3 hours behind schedule."
He hopped from the wagon as it rolled to a halt.
"I think it's nice," my mother said, walking around from the back of the wagon. "Gives us the chance for something hot."
She gave my father a significant look.
"To eat. Gets frustrating making do with whatever you can grab at the end of the day. A body wants more."
My father's mood seemed to temper considerably.
"There is that," he said.
"Sweet,"
my mother called to me.
"Do you think you could find me some wild sage? I don't know if it grows around here,"
I said with a proper amount of uncertainty in my voice.
"No harm in looking,"
she said sensibly. She looked at my father from the corner of her eye.
"If you can find enough, bring back an armload. We'll dry it for later."
Typically, whether or not I found what I was looking for didn't matter very much. It was my habit to wander away from the troop in the evenings. I usually had some sort of errand to run while my parents set up for dinner, but it was just an excuse for us to get away from each other. Privacy is hard to come by on the road, and they needed it as much as I did. So if it took me an hour to gather an armload of firewood, they didn't mind. And if they hadn't started dinner by the time I came back, well, that was only fair, wasn't it? I hope they spent those last few hours well. I hope they didn't waste them on mindless tasks, kindling the evening fire and cutting vegetables for dinner. I hope they sang together, as they so often did. I hope they retired to our wagon and spent time in each other's arms. I hope they lay near each other afterward and spoke softly of small things. I hope they were together, busy with loving each other until the end came. It is a small hope and pointless, really. They're just as dead either way. Still, I hope. Let us pass over the time I spent alone in the woods that evening, playing games that children invent to amuse themselves. The last carefree hours of my life, the last moments of my childhood. Let us pass over my return to the camp just as the sun was beginning to set, the sight of bodies strewn about like broken dolls, the smell of blood and burning hair. How I wandered aimlessly about, too disoriented for proper panic, numb with shock and dread. I would pass over the whole of that evening, in fact. I would spare you the burden of any of it, if one piece were not necessary to the story. It is vital. It is the hinge upon which the story pivots like an opening door. In some ways, this is where the story begins. So let's have done with it. Scattered patches of smoke hung in the still evening air. It was quiet, as if everyone in the troop was listening for something, as if they were all holding their breath. An idle wind tussled the leaves in the trees and wafted a patch of smoke like a low cloud towards me. I stepped out of the forest and through the smoke, heading into the camp. I left the cloud of smoke and rubbed some of the sting from my eyes. As I looked around, I saw Tripp's tent lying half-collapsed and smouldering in his fire. The treated canvas burned fitfully, and the acrid grey smoke hung close to the ground in the quiet evening air. I saw Terran's body lying by his wagon, his sword broken in his hand. The green and grey he normally wore was wet and red with blood. One of his legs was twisted unnaturally, and the splintered bone showing through the skin was very, very white. I stood unable to look away from Terran, the grey shirt, the red blood, the white bone. I stared as if it were a diagram in a book I was trying to understand. My body grew numb. I felt as if I was trying to think through syrup. Some small rational part of me realized I was in deep shock. It repeated the fact to me again and again. I used all Ben's training to ignore it. I did not want to think about what I saw. I did not want to know what had happened here. I did not want to know what any of this meant. After I don't know how long, a wisp of smoke broke my line of vision. I sat down next to the nearest fire in a daze. It was Shandy's fire, and a small pot hung simmering, boiling potatoes, strangely familiar among the chaos. I focused on the kettle, something normal. I used a stick to poke at the contents and saw that they were finished cooking. Normal. I lifted the kettle from the fire and set it on the ground next to Shandy's body. Her clothes hung in tatters about her. I tried to brush her hair away from her face, and my hand came back sticky with blood. The firelight reflected in her flat, empty eyes. I stood and looked about aimlessly. Tripp's tent was entirely aflame by now, and Shandy's wagon was standing with one wheel in Marion's campfire. All the flames were tinged with blue, making the scene dreamlike and surreal. I heard voices. Peering around the corner of Shandy's wagon, I saw several unfamiliar men and women sitting around a fire. My parents' fire. A dizziness swept over me, and I reached out a hand to steady myself against the wagon's wheel. When I gripped it, the iron bands that reinforced the wheel crumbled in my hand, flaking away in gritty sheets of brown rust. When I pulled my hand away, the wheel creaked and began to crack. I stepped back as it gave way, the wagon splintering as if its wood were rotten as an old stump. I now stood in full view of the fire. One of the men tumbled backward and came to his feet with his sword out. His motion reminded me of quicksilver rolling from a jar onto a tabletop, effortless and supple. His expression was intent, but his body was relaxed, as if he had just stood and stretched. His sword was pale and elegant. When it moved, it cut the air with a brittle sound. It reminded me of the quiet that settles on the coldest days in winter when it hurts to breathe and everything is still. He was 24 feet from me, but I could see him perfectly in the fading light of sunset. I remember him as clearly as I remember my own mother, sometimes better. His face was narrow and sharp, with the perfect beauty of porcelain. His hair was shoulder length, framing his face in loose curls the color of frost. He was a creature of winter's pale. Everything about him was cold and sharp and white, except his eyes. They were black, like a goat's, but with no iris. His eyes were like his sword, and neither one reflected the light of the fire or the setting sun. He relaxed when he saw me. He dropped the tip of his sword and smiled with perfect ivory teeth. It was the expression a nightmare wore. I felt a stab of feeling penetrate the confusion I clutched around me like a thick protective blanket. Something put both its hands deep into my chest and clutched. It may have been the first time in my life I was ever truly afraid. Back by the fire, a bald man with a grey beard chuckled.
Looks like we missed a little rabbit. Careful, Cinder. His teeth may be sharp.
The one called Cinder sheathed his sword with the sound of a tree cracking under the weight of winter ice. Keeping his distance, he knelt. Again, I was reminded of the way Mercury moved. Now on eye level with me, his expression grew concerned behind his matte black eyes.
What's your name, boy?
I stood there mute, frozen as a startled fawn. Cinder sighed and dropped his gaze to the ground for a moment. When he looked up at me, I saw pity staring at me with hollow eyes.
Young man, he said, wherever are your parents?
He held my gaze for a moment and then looked over his shoulder back towards the fire where the others sat.
Does anyone know where his parents are?
Some of them smiled, hard and brittle, as if enjoying a particularly good joke. One or two of them laughed aloud. Cinder turned back to me and the pity fell away like a cracked mask, leaving only the nightmare smile upon his face.
Is this your parents' fire?
He asked, with a terrible delight in his voice. I nodded numbly. His smile slowly faded. Expressionless, he looked deep into me. His voice was quiet, cold and sharp.
Someone's parents, he said, have been singing entirely the wrong sort of songs. Cinder.
A cool voice came from the direction of the fire. His black eyes narrowed in irritation.
What?
He hissed.
This one has done nothing. Send him to the soft and painless blanket of his sleep.
The cool voice caught slightly on the last word as if it were difficult to say. The voice came from a man who sat apart from the rest, wrapped in shadow at the edge of the fire. Though the sky was still bright with sunset and nothing stood between the fire and where he sat, shadow pooled around him like thick oil. The fire snapped and danced, lively and warm, tinged with blue, but no flicker of its light came close to him. The shadow gathered thicker around his head. I could catch a glimpse of a deep cowl like some priests wear, but underneath the shadows were so deep, it was like looking down a well at midnight. Cinder glanced briefly at the shadowed man, then turned away.
You are as good as a watcher, Haliax,
he snapped.
And you seem to forget our purpose,
the dark man said, his cool voice sharpening.
Or does your purpose simply differ from my own?
The last words were spoken carefully, as if they held special significance. Cinder's arrogance left him in a second, like water poured from a bucket.
No,
he said, turning back toward the fire.
No, certainly not.
That is good. I hate to think of our long acquaintance coming to an end.
As do I.
Refresh me again as to our relationship, Cinder,
the shadowed man said, a deep sliver of anger running through his patient tone.
I am in your service.
Cinder made a placating gesture.
You are a tool in my hand,
the shadowed man interrupted gently.
Nothing more.
A hint of defiance touched Cinder's expression. He paused.
The
soft voice went as hard as a rod of Ramsden steel.
Ferula!
Cinder's quicksilver grace disappeared. He staggered, his body suddenly rigid with pain.
You are a tool in my hand,
the cool voice repeated.
Say it.
Cinder's jaw clenched.